Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Dom Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. So, how about a brief recap from our previous podcast when we discussed how to protect your assets with security specialist Tara LeClaire from Alliance Security Systems. What did you think of that podcast, Bernie?
A couple of things came to light in that podcast. One, you saw somebody saw an opportunity and saw a problem and an opportunity and explored it. You went from electrician to alarm installations. Great, great idea. You know, there's a void in the market. And then the other important piece that came out of that was that, you know, if you're your do-it-yourselfer, right, and you're buying stuff off the shelf, it's not going to be the same as a professional when they come in. You know, you don't want to have something that has an open back door, so to speak, where someone could break in and defeat your system. It was a pretty good session.
Yeah, he did make a point of saying that sure, you can buy an alarm system off the shelf, but how secure is it, really? You know, and with some of the gizmos I see advertised, I mean, just, you know, you really, that's something that you don't want to skimp on for sure. That was a great, great podcast. It was great to have Terrell on. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie? You've
got mail. Well, yeah. Tony from Windsor, Ontario says he's owned a 45,000 square foot strip plaza for almost 5 years now. And from all indications, they're going to need to replace the roof shortly. And they've had it repaired and patched a bunch of times. How do you determine if it really needs to be replaced? He doesn't really necessarily trust the roofing contractors he's met so far.
The contractor business. Our guest today is just ideal for this type of question, but I'm not going to put him on the spot quite yet. Thank you for your question, Tony. Roofing. Once you start patching and repairing, it's more than likely you're going to have to replace it shortly. Outside of the obvious indicators, like having to repair it constantly, detecting and locating roof leaks is often difficult, and it's next to impossible by just looking at its surface. Often the surface may be covered with some sort of ballast, like a stone or gravel, which makes it impossible to find where the roof is leaking. There are, however, some investigative techniques that can be used. For instance, a thermographic scan. During the daytime, the sun heats up the surface of the roof and the insulation below the roof membrane. At night, when the temperature drops, any wet areas below the roof membrane will retain the daytime heat longer. A roofing specialist will go on top of the roof during the evening with a thermographic scanning device and locate any hot spots. The tech will then usually take a spray paint or spray gun and circle around the hot spots and reinvestigate those spots the following day. If merited, a temporary patch can be made that same day. It's not the solution, but it's a temporary remedy. Another way to make a determination as to whether the roof needs to be replaced is to hire an engineering company to conduct a cut test. What's a cut test? And why do you need an engineering company to do it? Well, a cut test requires that an engineer cuts into the existing roof membrane to find out if the insulation or the roof decking is wet. The cut is then sent to a laboratory where the sample is divided into its various components and measurements are taken to determine how much material is left. With that information, a guesstimate of the remaining lifespan of the roof can be made. Now, you can still do a cut test and not have to send it to an engineering company. Sometimes it's so obvious that the tech who's doing it will be able to tell you on the spot how badly the roof is damaged. The downside to this type of analysis, obviously, is its cost. A full analysis of the roof, like what we speak of above, can cost anywhere from $2,500 to $5,000, depending on the number of cuts sent to the laboratory. This may seem expensive, and it is. However, considering the huge capital expenditure you're about to undertake, it may be money well spent. It's impossible to cover all the ins and outs of replacing a commercial roof. As a matter of fact, Bernie, we could dedicate an entire podcast to it. But I will say this, that money spent at this stage, that is money spent to properly investigate the issue, can save you tens of thousands of dollars when it comes time to replace your roof.
That's great, Fred. And, there's an old adage, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
So if you have any questions for Fred, send your email to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Welcome back, listeners. Well, in the news today, I've chosen a couple of different articles. The first that I would like to present to you is one written by Blair Crawford from the Ottawa Citizen, and it first appeared on January 27th, 2024. Now, it's entitled, Ottawa Overhauling Zoning Bylaws, It Will Change the City Forever. Now, as you're well aware, this podcast isn't limited to the goings-on here in Eastern Ontario. This article is applicable to most any other municipality across North America. But it's interesting to see how they're dealing with it. So let me quote from Blair's article. Work begins on the Comprehensive Zoning Bylaw Amendment in March, and that's March of 2024, and likely won't be complete until the end of 2025. So it's quite a process. It's going to take them almost 2 years. The zoning revamp will open up new areas of Ottawa to infill development, which until now has been largely concentrated in and around the downtown core. At its core is the move by Ottawa and cities across Canada to end what is known as exclusionary zoning. Now, it's labeled exclusionary because the cost of housing there puts those neighborhoods out of the reach of low-income families. In Ottawa, those areas are known as R1 zoning. The federal government has made it clear, and the Ontario government has made it law, that exclusionary zoning must end. Ottawa's official plan, which was passed in 2022, so not that long ago, effectively ended R1 zoning. And Premier, and we're talking about the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford's controversial Bill 23, the More Homes Built Faster Act, directs all Ontario municipalities to allow three or more residential units per building lot. Now, there's apparently $4 billion up for grabs. And just as a bit of an aside, Ottawa has just recently received $176 million from the feds to build more affordable housing within the city. Let me get back to the article. Ottawa's zoning bylaws still contain rules about such things as setbacks from property lines and building heights that are counter to the increased density goals of the official plan. Squeezing three or more units on one lot is difficult if the bylaw says you can only build so high and must be a certain number of meters from the property line. So think about it. It makes absolute sense. You know, sure, build three houses, but by the time the setbacks and everything are taken into consideration, you know, you get a postage size area in which to build. So something had to be done. We're hoping there's going to be a lot more simplicity, says Jason Burgraff, Executive Director of the Greater Ottawa Home Builders Association. There was a rule that said R4 apartments, but no senior residences. Why? Jason goes on to say. Why ban that type of use? It could have been instituted decades ago because someone didn't want a senior's residence near their house, and it just got carried over the years and through amalgamation. It's those weird kind of particularities that we have to clean out. Originally, the official plan sought to limit building heights to four stories along minor corridors. Roads such as like Churchill Avenue and Fisher Avenue in Ottawa, for example, which are not, they're thoroughfares, but they're not major thoroughfares. Ontario overrode that after some hiccups tied to its controversial plan to expand urban boundaries and raise the height limit to 6 stories along minor corridors, a change now embraced by Ottawa Council. So that has been a monumental shift. So the second thing that I want to bring to your attention is an article entitled How to Build Generational Wealth in Real Estate with Bill 23. Now, we're talking about Bill 23 again, and that appeared in the previous article that I paraphrased. And what it's referencing is this More Homes Built Faster Act that the province has mandated into law. This article first appeared in January 2022 and was written by Ferris Elsobon of OGC Limited. And I've reached out to Ferris. I think he'd probably make an excellent guest. And let me paraphrase what he's written here. An historic event happened when Bill 23 received royal assent on November 28th, 2022. Whether it was historic or not, I'm not so sure, but I'm just paraphrasing. The official name is the More Homes Built Faster Act. Prior to Bill 23, if you wanted to convert your property, officially termed a single dwelling unit or SDU, into a multi-unit property, you would need to cut through a lot of red tape, long-form documents, and lengthy wait periods. And you'd be inundated with the process and the exorbitant fees and costs. And that is so true. That is a full stop for so many developers. And you have to keep in mind that most of the people that are going to build these type of units are like mom and pop type operations. They're small contractors. They're small businesses. There's no attraction or motivation for a major builder to come in and, you know, do this type of infill project. So he goes on to say, this has now changed and it could affect you as a homeowner, which opens up a new opportunity to build generational wealth with real estate in Ottawa. So what does that mean? Simply put, you can now convert your home or property into three or more units without the long waiting period, exorbitant fees, and high costs. It could instantly multiply your revenue stream and increase the value of your property. So there's something that is kind of, I haven't mentioned it before in previous podcasts, but there's something that's being quoted as being the missing middle. So what is the missing middle? The missing middle is a term that often comes up in discussions around intensification. It is used to describe the range of housing types between single detached houses and large apartment buildings that seem to have gone missing from many cities in the last 60 or 70 years. And when you think about it, a lot of these thoroughfares, it's just that. You see these post-Second World War buildings that are maybe 3-4 stories in height. And that used to be the status quo. That's what builders built. That's what apartment units used to be in. That's changed. Very few people, developers today, build those actual type of residences. So he goes on to use as an example, just case in point. He says, a typical low-income family, which has a total of 6 people, cannot afford to buy or rent a house, townhouse, or semi-detached, and would need a 3-bedroom apartment unit. This is a great example of who would need that missing middle type of rentals. Now, we spoke last podcast about these keyed 3-bedroom units that some developers are building, which actually allow you to sever off a single apartment unit. So the case in point in all this is that there are options available, and some builders are actually taking advantage of the difference in the rules and building these units, but just not at a pace that is anywhere near enough to solve the issue at hand. So as a final point, and in case you're wondering about developmental charges, this is an important point. It's important for you to know that the missing middle type of projects will not require development charges. Well, that's a real plus. Keep in mind that missing middle projects is the conversion of a single semi or townhouse into 3 units. But a project that you're looking to build will have the regular and normal development fees attached. So all this is great positive news. So do what you will. There's, as we're fond of saying, if there are no problems, Bernie,
there are no opportunities.
And here's a solution and an opportunity for you, listener.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Nicholas Karangis is a dedicated project consultant and partner at the design and build firm Ottawa General Contractors. At the age of just 38, he has over 16 years of experience in residential construction and thousands of successful projects encompassing land acquisition, low-rise investment buildings, new home construction, infill developments, coach home building, and residential renovations under his belt. Wow, that's quite a resume. The challenge of creating unique, efficient, and ergonomic designs that result in a long-lasting positive difference in both the lives of his clients and landscape of his hometown of Ottawa is what attracted him to residential construction. As a father of two entertaining boys who love to spend time in nature or playing basketball and baseball, a husband to a loving wife who is passionate about cooking and music, and Nicholas's love of motorsports, his time away from the office is either zen or adrenaline-seeking, to put it in his words. Well put, Nicholas. Nicholas also says that he's fortunate to share his time with such amazing people who are looking to enhance the future and make great things possible. Now, a little bit about the firm Nicholas works with, Ottawa General Contracting, or OGC. OGC was created in 2009 as one of Canada's first design and build construction companies. Initially a family-run business, OGC has quickly become the leading design plus build firm in Ottawa. Ottawa General Contractors delivers construction projects for both residential and commercial clients. A defined and repeated business process is the foundation of OGC's success. Attention to detail, financial oversight, and project management allow OGC to successfully deliver over 130 projects a year. Having multiple divisions under one roof, OGC can accommodate interior renovations, additions, custom homes, coach homes, and multi-unit development projects. Welcome to the show, Nick. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you, Bernie. Super excited to be here on the Property Wizard podcast. Appreciate you guys having me and excited, looking forward to this.
We're excited to have you on. It's so appropriate. You know, and really, you're the bona fide expert when it comes to things like roofing repairs. So I hope I didn't make a fool of myself.
You aced it. A plus.
Great. Great to know. Thanks for that vote of confidence, Nick. Yeah. Wow. You sound like you've got it all together. This is just wonderful. Love your mention about your wife and your kids and, you know, the fact that you're a little bit of a adrenaline junkie, too. You can take it, you know, zen or like that. That's just brilliant. Good for you. And the experience that you have, just incredible. It's really great to have you on. So let's start off with this. Tell us a little bit about what both you and Ottawa General Contractors, OGC, does. What do you do?
Yeah. So Ottawa General Contractors, as you mentioned quickly, is Ottawa's leading design and build company. We specialize in full service projects. And we want to account and help everyone that we can. So we have different divisions within our organization. And we have the capacity to handle everything from a single kitchen renovation up to a 30-unit multifamily investment build. I'm one of the partners at OGC, and my role is a project consultant. So really what I do is I manage all the stakeholders, clients, our designers, our estimators, engineer, material coordinators, basically putting everybody together to determine project feasibility, and then actually mapping out, you know, accurate plans, render scopes of work, and preparing that for our construction team in order to do the full project management and execute on the client's vision.
Wow, that's really a full service organization. I've actually seen one of the packages that Nick and OGC have put together, and it is quite impressive. We had a bit of a conversation before recording how much the general contracting business, construction business, has really changed over the years, but very, very impressive. So
long way from the dude in a white truck showing up and writing a quote on a napkin and sketching out a floor plan and going like, yeah, it'll be 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, right?
Nick, this might come as a shock to you, but there's still a lot of people out there like that.
We see it. It's always, I'll try not to go down the scary rabbit hole of the construction side and residential, right? But it is, I still see those quotes where it's like, you know, a $300,000 project and it's one page and it basically just has like a summary on it, you know, whereas we do like a 40-page detailed scope of work with a fixed price. And I'm looking there going like, how is this client protected? Like, how do you know what you're getting? It's so subjective. Like, what do you mean provide big windows? Like, what's a big window? What does that mean? You know, what's a high quality finish? Like, I don't know, if you ask my sister versus you ask your mom and your aunt and whatever, like, you're going to get such varying opinions on that stuff, right?
Oh, I'm laughing because I've seen it. I know exactly what you speak of all day long. So I know I mentioned this before. Did you actually join and create Ottawa General Contractors, Nick? Is your involvement with them being right from the get-go from 2009?
No. So that's what OGC was founded by two of our majority partners back then. And then I joined roughly about 8-9 years ago. I had previously a career in new construction, new development, which was wonderful. One of the leading builders here in Ottawa. So I got great experience being able to see everything from raw land acquisition through to building custom homes and low-rise condos and all that fun stuff and the sales side and the marketing side and all the project management. And then, basically OGC was looking for, at the time, they mostly did renovations. So they were looking to kind of jump into new custom building and development building. And that's how our paths sort of crossed.
Brilliant. Great. Is there one particular, because you've got quite a repertoire of services being offered, is there one particular scope of work that OGC really excels at? Or is that kind of an unfair question? Because it really kind of sounds like you're right across the board. But is there, on a percentage weighted scale, what takes up most of your time, or your, out of the 130 projects that you do approximately a year, how many of those would be like home renovations?
Yeah, so the majority of the business is renovations. And, you know, typically we're looking at full home interior updates with additions, any kind of, you know, high risk second levels, rear bump outs, that sort of thing. And then a mix of coach homes, custom builds, and then the investment builds. So, you know, typically we're doing at least about, you know, in the range of 5 to 10 multifamily builds a year. We're doing anywhere from sort of 2 to 4 custom homes. And then we're typically doing about, you know, 8+ coach houses. And then the rest is all renovations.
I'm really interested to, like, that's a fair number of coach houses. That's actually really quite interesting to see. You know, look, Ottawa is not a small landscape. Eastern Ontario isn't a small landscape. I'm not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes, but just the idea of a coach house. I mean, if we would have had this discussion 3-4 years ago, the vast majority of our listeners would have no idea what it was we were talking about. Because we've had several podcasts that have been related to and involved just that, what we call auxiliary dwelling units.
You got it. And even if we were having this conversation 3-4 years ago, the numbers would be nowhere near that, right? And we were the very first in Ottawa to get the first coach home building permit. And we've done the most of them so far in the city. We've done everything from, you know, the standard sort of 400 or 500 square foot unit up to recently we did a 1400 square foot coach home with a garage, wow, 2 stories, you know, handled a big variance process and everything there for the client. So we've really done the full range in those. And, you know, why we jumped on board is we used to own a Vancouver General Contractors. And so we saw out west how the landscape of residential ownership was changing, right? You know, 10 years ago out in Vancouver, you required a secondary dwelling unit or 2 secondary ADUs to basically afford a house, right? And so we noticed that trend sort of starting to come towards Ottawa and jumped on board with it right away and brought our part of our construction team from Vancouver over here to Ottawa to spearhead it.
Yeah, you are dead on again. We've spoken about that, I don't know how many times, and very often are in the news segment when we're speaking specifically about ADUs. We're going back to BC, we're going back to the Vancouver area, because they, quite frankly, are miles ahead of the rest of at least Canada. I mean, not so much in the States, but they're more in line as far as progress in that field is concerned. They have a very restrictive, it's easy to point to BC housing policy with a critical eye, but there's another side of the coin that people most people just aren't aware of. And that's that things like what we're speaking about, you know, ADUs, like they've just introduced that to Eastern Ontario, well, right across Ontario. But, you know, for the sake of this conversation, Eastern Ontario, that's a relatively recent phenomena that all of a sudden you can do this. Well, they've been allowed to do that in BC for the past 3-4 years now, maybe that long, maybe not quite. But even them, I mean, we were speaking about ADUs in some areas of California, and we spoke about them extensively, about how they've essentially done away with what they're trying to do here with, you know, restrictive or exclusionary zoning, which we commonly refer to as R1 zoning. But they've been doing this in the Western Seaboard, primarily in California, for quite some time. And it's great to see it here. So a little bit of a deviation. Bernie.
Actually, Nick, you're going to be able to answer this question much better than Fred, but Fred probably could too. So you're going to start a project up. How do you know it's worthwhile? Like, you know, whether it's greenfield, brownfield, redeveloped, how do you determine, like, yeah, that's a good idea. Someone's going to buy it because at the end of the day, that's what you're going to need, but also it's going to be cost effective.
Makes sense. Yeah, really the sort of first steps, or I guess the steps to determining a project feasibility, what we do, our very first assessment would be to do a zoning review just to confirm what a property can accommodate. We typically do, you know, on-site review just to see the general. In terms of determining the project feasibility, basically our first step would be to do a zoning review just to see what the potential is with a particular property. And then basically, if needed, we would do site review to determine the existing conditions. And then usually what we do is put together concept plans, we do pricing, and then we would do financial performa of a project, right? When it's investment-based, that's the most critical thing. Are we getting the right debt coverage ratios? Are we getting the right equity positions? So really quickly, before anybody commits any kind of money, we do that as a no-charge service, because we don't want people, you know, the traditional path is you go call an architect, you get a set of plans, or you go spend thousands and thousands of dollars, and then you start to price it out, and then you find out, oh, this doesn't make any sense. You go to a lender, and they say, no way, this is ridiculous, right? So we do it really quickly so that people can determine, you know, do I buy that property? Do I continue forward with any kind of plans on a property that I already own? Whatever the case may be, right? And we can do that fast for them.
Have you ever found that you found that the zoning wasn't bang on for what you want to do? So do you ever go back to get it rezoned? Is that worthwhile? Or is that, because I've owned property before and we wanted to sever it, and the guy says, it's going to be really hard. It might be agriculture. The only way you can sever it is if there's a waterway there or someone puts a road in and it belongs to the county. That becomes a natural severance. So do you ever find that you have to go back to the council or planning committee and say, listen, can we rezone this?
Yeah, we've definitely done that on projects. We've done full rezones, severances, variances, all that. I would say, in my experience, it always just comes down to a client's comfort level, right? And so one of the great things now that, you know, we'll probably speak a little bit more about is, like, with Bill 23, the ability to take any single property and convert it into three units, it's really opened up what you typically see in higher density zoning to basically any property. So yes, you could take potentially an R1 property, rezone it to an R4, put a multi-unit on it. But you might spend 3 years doing this and hundreds of thousands of dollars, where in that 3-year period, you're probably better off to take the current property, turn it into three units, refinance it, buy two more, do that. And then your net worth has gone up substantially. Your cash flow has gone up substantially. And you haven't felt like you've been beating your head against the wall trying to spend 3-4 years rezoning. And you're like, you know, at that final 11th hour, you're like, did I really just spend $400,000 in 3 years of my life and I don't have an answer yet? So it's possible, but, you know, often the highest and best use is maybe not the best case scenario to go through when you look at the bigger picture, right?
I'm glad you said that, because I have another client where we've had quite a discussion going back and forth about just that. Do you spend the money? You know, wouldn't it be better to maybe sell and then buy something else? And exactly the scenario. I got to put you in touch with him. Anyways, and I think you've already answered this question. What I find quite amazing is, in reference to what it would cost to put together a detailed work plan for a property owner, OGC actually will take that project and give the homeowner cost estimates and a project estimate for that?
Yeah, so at no charge, we do our first feasibility study, because really quickly, again, we want to give people the information to make decisions so that they can move forward in their life, right? And so we do that initial part at no cost. And then when someone's like, I want to go deeper, let's start getting into actually doing the plan sets. Let's do plot plans. Let's start to price this out to an exact specific scope of work with a fixed price so that we can actually get a lending approval, those sort of things. Then we start to take a deposit there. Usually that ranges anywhere from about $5,000 up to about $15,000. And then when someone signs up to actually build with us, we credit that back to them. And that initial fee includes basically the full detailed zoning review, full detailed set of plans, 3D renders, itemized fixed price scope of work, and we work with the lending partners to get the financial approval on the performer there as well.
So when you talk about lending partners, will you actually assist the homeowner in securing financing for the project?
Yeah, and it's actually easiest that way, right? Because we deal with folks that specialize in, you know, whether it's improvements to their primary residence or going through a 30-unit financing for there under like a CMHC program or even private financing. So depending on the client's cases, depending on their timelines, we'll put them in touch with the exact lending partner that is best suited for the project and their needs. And then we basically send all the documents and facilitate everything and answer all the questions to make the lending process as fast and as easy as possible.
So have you done any projects involving CMHC's, I think it's an M1 program?
The MLI Select. Yep. So we've done a few of them. And in fact, in one case, we actually got the approval for the client because we were the builder. So the client's ratios were a little bit off, but CMHC did the final approval because we were actually the ones who were going to be building the project. And they had the confidence that we're here for the long term. We have the financial stability. We have the guaranteed fixed price with the full project management. So yeah, we've gone through it. It's a great program. Like anything, there's cons to it, right? That there are, you know, any great offer often has a little catch or two to it, and it certainly does. But overall, it's a great program to use for the multi-units.
Because we have investors currently right now looking for the, M1 Select eligible properties. Because, you know, for our listeners in the U.S., what we're talking about, it's a government-sponsored program through what we call Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And what they can offer someone either building new or renovating existing are longer-term mortgages up to 40 years. You can get increased amortization periods. The interest rates are, depending on which program specifically, what you're doing, the interest rates can be either a little lower or a little higher because there is a fee attached to it. But the fact that you're able to increase the amortization period makes it much more affordable, and the numbers actually work. And this is all determined by a point system. So essentially, if it qualifies because it's energy efficient, there's a certain number of points that the project garners. If a certain number of the units, or if you agree to rent out a certain number of the units to lower income families or individuals, that will garner a certain number of points. And if you have at the end of the day the required or enough points, the project generally gets the green light. Then the next step really is exactly that's when you want to call somebody like Nick. You know, but I would imagine, Nick, that you would work hand in hand with the property owner or the developer at that stage and with CMHC to make sure all the boxes are checked. Is that a fair assumption?
That's 100% it. Yeah, knowing that even right from the get-go, knowing if CMHC, the MLI Select program, is a path we want to go down, it starts with the building design. It starts with the construction specs to hit those point systems. And, you know, there's without, we probably spent a whole podcast on the system alone, but you know, we want to gear it towards what the client wants to achieve. And then we figure out how to fit that within the correct point system to achieve the amortization and interest rates that we need to.
You and I are going to be spending a lot of time together in the future. Bernie.
Well, Nick, we just talked about things that are fairly large projects relative, you know, to housing. For the more smaller ones, like, you know, say somebody wants to redo their basement or they have an outbuilding they want to kind of rid in. Yeah, how much is it going to cost per square foot to do a refit, either of an existing structure?
Yeah, generally speaking, if you're going to do like a basement unit or you've got an existing structure and you're going to retro it, convert it into a full legal unit, generally speaking, you're ranging between about $120 to about $170 a square foot, which usually equates to, unlike most basements, you're in and around about the low $100,000 mark to sometimes up to close to about $200,000 to create a unit. And those costs really, you know, as with any project, of course, there's the finishes and the construction specs and things like that that drive a price point there. But specifically with units, there's a lot of things that, you know, compared to building a normal basement are required. Egress points, fire separation, mechanical separations, and even there's minimum room requirement sizes based on building code that we need to adhere to. And that's ultimately what starts to drive the cost. Example being, are we good with just a egress window as one source, or for the, you know, particular layout of a client's house, do we need to dig down and build a full concrete set of stairs coming from the outside into the basement? Do they want that space to be covered and heated and cooled and everything as well, right? So alone that can drive over $30,000 of cost on a project, right?
So with the lending institutions, if you were to do a project like that, is that something you found lending institutions would want to help support, knowing that the value of the residence goes up and that there would be a income stream coming from that?
Generally speaking, yes. Anytime you're adding value to a property and then bringing income in, the lenders see that as a favorable project and would typically support it.
So what are the specific challenges related to converting a single family residence into a legal duplex? So you spoke fairly extensively about the zoning. What other things need to be done when you're talking about the scope of work for a conversion? Let's say you have a standard, you know, like you have a bungalow, for instance, and you talked about the means of egress, you talked about the zoning, but there are other very specific requirements from a construction standpoint that are really, or a homeowner should be aware of when it comes to a conversion project like that?
Yeah. For any conversions, and even if it's taking a single family home, turning it into a duplex, or now with Bill 23, converting into three units, the two biggest things are really with the egress points. So, you know, for anybody that's unaware of it, a path to escape, you know, the property, right? And then the other one would be the fire separation. So, you know, as an example, if you took a traditional single family home, a two-story single family home, you convert it into three units, you put, you know, one unit up on the top level, you basically have two options. You either need to have like two full sets of staircases that everyone shares on each level. So the top unit, you know, then has those 2 points to escape, or you have one single direct staircase for each unit. So they've got their own private egress point. And that's a big variation that can have significant cost swings to a particular project. And then a really high level rule of thumb is that any common surface, any common area must be fire separated. And so those are two of the biggest cost drivers, two of the biggest considerations that you need to look at when converting any property into any kind of multiple unit scenario.
So if you have, for instance, what happens in a situation where you have a home that's heated by forced air, natural gas furnace, and the furnace is situated as they usually are in the lower level, in the basement, let's say. So are there any specific issues or challenges when that furnace is used to heat the entire residence?
Most of the units that we would do, we would actually cap one of the spaces. So typically we would shut off the HVAC system to the basement as an example, and then put the basement on its own independent system. But you don't legally need to do that. You can run the entire building off of one centralized system. What you do need to do though, is you need to put in the fire alert systems and the baffles so that basically it'll catch the fire quicker and alert everyone in each unit so that fire isn't spreading between the units through the HVAC system. But you can have an entire building on shared services there. it's not the most ideal for a few reasons, right? You know, especially when you get in, if you're getting into like independent billing and tenants paying different, all the different bills, it becomes obviously much more complicated. So a lot of times we suggest to split the services, and we typically do that on our projects, but you don't have to do that. It's definitely an area of cost savings.
So, you know, because these things have come so far, the technology behind them has come so far, would it make sense to just completely remove the furnace so that you've got additional space, primarily in the basement, and then maybe put like a heat pump?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So that is 100% it. Like when you're, especially when you're crafting it from new, and if you are doing a conversion, ideally you do remove them, right? It frees up a tremendous amount of space and doesn't require you to fully fire separate that mechanical room as well. So yeah, if you go independent systems, you can do the ductless heat pumps as well. And then each level will have its own independent control. It can be metered independently. It can be controlled independently. It's far, far better than one centralized. It comes down to numbers, right? And yeah. Looking at, does it make sense to do that upfront investment for the longer term, or do you just use what you've got and get the wheels turning on the project?
Yeah, well, it kind of makes, I you know, I've looked at different projects with that thought exactly in mind. Does it make sense? But it would seem to me if you're doing that kind of renovation and you want to escape the issues related to, you know, the loss of space and even, quite frankly, efficiency, if the tenant is paying for the hydro, I mean, a heat pump will supply both heat and air conditioning. So at the end of the day, seems to me you almost kill two birds with one stone, because there is no effective way to heat or air condition, I suppose, you know, in the scenario that we first painted, each one of those units, you know, effectively, at least that's my opinion. I would be much more apt to take the furnace out and put a heat pump in each unit. You know, that way it's individually controlled, individually monitored, and individually paid for. But that's just me.
I would vote with that as well. Yeah, because do you really want to have your tenant calling you in the middle of the summer to be like, you know, it's boiling hot in my space, and the other person being like, it's freezing in mine, and they're just fighting over temperature all the time? Like, is that really a phone call you want to have on your investment, right?
Yeah. I've had that issue happen in a 16-unit building that we actually heavily renovated, and it was actually a co-tenancy group that I'd put together. And the way it was situated, there was one thermostat. It was a boiler-type system. And the rooms were all bachelors, and or the units were all bachelors, rather. And that was a constant area. Like, it was just an issue during the my, you know, my unit's too hot, my unit's too cold, my this, my that. And this was long before anyone even heard of a heat pump. But it's great to know that technology is there. And I know that's a topic for another day. We're going to have you back. I know that. Bernie.
Well, it's going to kind of go back. When you're talking about doing separate billing, are you then relying on, let's say, if it's electrical or it's the gas company or the water supply, that you have separate meters set up? Or do you set up a meter and then you parse it out based on consumption, the secondary measuring device? Or is it a lot easier just to have the utility bill directly to the client?
Our preferred path and typical path would be to divide all the services, so that it is direct from the service provider that the billing is done. Easier to control, very clear to do it that way. But again, you do not have to do it that way. So you could keep all centralized services, and then you could do the secondary monitoring to actually divide consumption and divide bills. Again, it's one of those that I would rather spend the upfront cost to have it clean and easy versus the fighting and negotiating over the nickels and the dimes later, and just the brain damage that potentially comes along with the secondary source, right? Yeah, like the goal, I think, always is take the path of least resistance, invest your money in real estate, and just see checks come back, give people nice spaces to live in that are simple, easy, clean, and they enjoy it, and everyone's happy, versus the like try to squeeze a couple of nickels out of it and cause yourself, you know, significant brain damage.
Well, it's either you're going to get brain damage that way, or you're going to get brain damage from all the alcohol you'll be drinking.
Well, actually, I think from a service point of view, because if something goes wrong, gas company, water supply, whatever the case might be, they're going to fix it, not you. So you just took yourself out of a maintenance piece per se, you know, a delivery service piece. And it also helps the tenant to get their own profile, because I know that if having managed that space and someone moved out of the building that I controlled, they asked me for a letter of reference for their hydro, their electrical, because, you know, they have no back history. So that's a good way to start that.
Makes sense. That's another bonus I never thought of. Thank you. Yeah, that is really great. And it really does give them an independent feel, right? Like, you don't want people to feel like they're being forced into scenarios. You want to give them the total independence, right, that they deserve, and make them, you know, feel like the space is theirs really at the end of the day.
Someone says, listen, I want to make that space happen. I want to build that structure. So how long does it go from initial date of the consultation to, you know, make it happen? How long does that whole process take? And how long does the permit process take? Does it really go smoothly, or is that dependent on time of year or what? The moon phases?
Here, follow the moon cycles. Yes. Yeah, we just like on TV, we do all of our projects in like under 30 minutes or less, you know, minus commercial breaks, right? Of course, there's our verbal guarantee for everybody, right? in reality, though, no, we're looking like there's a couple components, right? So first component would be our planning process. And generally, that takes 1 to 2 months to get through that. We submit for building permits. City's really great. I feel very bad for them. They're very, very overwhelmed, right? There's a lot of projects, a lot of changes, a lot of things happening. So the turnaround times can be anywhere from, you know, 2-3 weeks really quick on a simple permit to sometimes you're looking at multiple months before you're getting something back. And then in terms of a start date, you know, the permit is a critical item. Depending on project, you may have, you know, a new construction build or an addition. You've got roof systems, you've got floor packages. Those are long lead time items. So then usually once we've completed the planning process, which again takes a month or two, then we're usually looking at about 2 to 4 months before we can actually start the project, because then we've got the critical items we can actually build efficiently. And then depending on the size of the project, you know, you're anywhere from 2 to 3 months on a straightforward, simple project up to, you know, new construction, your 5 to 8 months type timeframe, right?
That's great. Super. So how does that compare to the construction of like a standalone carriage home or a driveway ADU?
Yeah, one of our favorites, of course. They're pretty straightforward. When we do the initial zoning assessment, really quickly, we determine whether it's feasible or not. So very quick calculations, you look at 40% of the yard size they're going to go in, 40% of the footprint of the house, whatever smaller, that's your maximum size you can go to. There are rules that state that if it's, you know, really skewed, you do have minimums that you can hit around about 500 square feet as an example. And then the coach homes are quick. Yeah, we've got a bunch of different options and models that already exist. So a lot of times clients will just take 80, 90% of what we've already done before and tweak it to their particular taste. And then it's really quick into submitting for permits and build turnaround time. Sometimes we're getting those like under 3 months for a build. You know, they're a house at the end of the day, but they're smaller volume, so we can fire through them. Usually we're wise enough to give you a schedule of 5 or 6 months, right? And then if it goes faster, everybody's happy, but they can go at a pretty efficient pace, which is wonderful.
So are you going to build something like that on a slab, or is it going to be, you know, wood frame?
Yeah, most of the time they are built on a slab. You can do a basement with a coach home. So you could do a full foundation. You could have the basement space available, but majority of them are done on a slab because it typically the cost that you start to incur with doing the basement. And once you start to put staircases and hallways into the layouts, you're looking at not gaining a huge amount of additional functional square footage, and you're just driving up the cost at the end of the day, right? So I think we've maybe done 2 with a basement.
Yeah. So I suspected.
When you're doing projects, and this, if you had multiple projects all at the same time, whether it's a landlord, maybe they have 3 or 4 houses, they're trying to go from a single family dwelling to, you know, multi-residential or ADUs in that space, is there a kind of a cost benefit for them to do multiples and say, hi, Nick, I've got 5 places and I need to make them 10 or 12 or 15 doors available to the client base. And they decide to do it on one swoop. Or it's all in one space, or it's kind of scattered. Does that make a difference? Does that help in the price point? Does that make it more deliverable?
Yeah, great question, Bernie. Thank you. It always sounds self-interested when we say, yes, of course, it is more beneficial, right? We're like, yeah, well, great. We'd rather take on a bigger project. But it ultimately just, it is always suggested that you do as much as you can in one go, because ultimately, anytime you engage in any project, you've got flat cost, right? Whether you're building a basement or you're building a multi-unit building, you've got engineering, you've got building permits, you've got waste bins, dust protection, floor protection. You've got all these things that are incurred. You've got every single inspection happening. You've got every single trade showing up, right? So, you know, if an electrician is going to come and put two pot lights in your house, well, he's going to charge you for the decommission, the rough-in, and the install. And if it's two pot lights, it's only going to take him maybe, you know, a couple hours to pop this thing in maximum, but he's still got to show up. He's still going to charge you for at least half a day to a day. You might as well, like, you can wire up half a house in that time, right? So definitely it's better to put more in one, because you're just taking advantage of the flat cost at the end of the day, right?
Well, you're looking at the cost, and let's go from that to the city or the municipality. So what do you expect as a property owner? You know, you've just added your basement apartment, you have egress, it's meeting all the code, or you're an outbuilding that you're converting over into an additional unit. What is a city? What do they come back and say, listen, pay us X? What do you expect?
In terms of like a property tax increase, or do you mean in terms of like building permits, any fees, development?
Well, yes, all of the above. How much are they going to pay on a regular basis? But even let's say you put in more water service or an extended drain or extended sewer, extended water supply, you know, let's say it's an exterior building.
Yeah. So with our scopes of work, they are fixed price, and we put all of these components into it. So when we give out pricing, it does include all these things like the building engineering and the permits and all of your service connections and things like that. But yeah, typically like building permits, they aren't super expensive. They're a very small percentage of the value of a project, right? So like you're doing a unit in a basement, you're, you know, a few hundred dollars for a building permit as an example. One of the really wonderful things about the Bill 23 now is that there are no development fees for adding these additional units. So you're saving quite a substantial amount there. Typically, you know, you're looking at $20,000 plus per unit in development fees, usually when you're doing a project. So the Bill 23 is helping to take that off the table. And then in terms of like added cost from, you know, like an annual tax perspective, what we found is that it's a little hit or miss what people see from increases, but the actual guideline that you should use is anytime your property goes up in value, no matter what you do to it, you should be adding that to the total and then using the current mill rate from the city to determine your property tax. So if you pay, you know, a $500,000 house and you're paying $5,000 a year in property tax, your house goes up $100,000, you should probably expect that you're going to be going up a good $500 a month in the increased value of the house, regardless of what you've done to it. Particularly with the coach houses, we've noticed that most of our clients have said they've seen basically like no change to anything. Many of our clients have been like, we haven't noticed really any increases to water consumption because they're shared services. We haven't noticed really any property tax changes, but don't make your investment decision based on that, right? That's a bonus if it happens. You should always account for whatever value you're adding, add that to your tax rate, look at your tax bill, it'll show you the mill rate, and then just multiply by that and account for that, because that's really how it should be determined, right?
Yep, you're absolutely dead on in that, what you're saying, Nick. That's very, very true. So you brought it up, Bill 23. So how much has Bill 23 impacted the building and the renovation industry?
Yeah, so far it's been like many new things to Ottawa. We're a little bit slow to adapt. So we've been seeing a huge amount of inquiries and people starting to make a bunch of conversions. We've started to do conversions where we've taken split level homes, turned them into two units, add a coach house in the back. So you end up with a total of three units. We've taken bungalows, chopped off the roof, added a second story, converted it into three units, you know, one on the top, one on the main, one in the basement. So we've been doing a ton of these projects. And I really think that the floodgates have not opened yet, because based on the conversations we're having, based on the information we're sharing, every time I sit down with someone, every time I have a conversation, even with family members, you know, they're like, what does this really mean? And I'm like, well, simply put, if there's a property in Ontario, you can take it from one unit to three units. And every single person's like, no, but like not our house, not our house in suburbia, not on our street. Like my neighbor can't do that, right? And I'm like, yes, your neighbor can do that. You can do that. You don't need special permission. You can basically, you know, and this is not the correct language, you can take your single home and turn it into a triplex. You don't need any special exceptions. You just need to fit building code, fire separation, and egress, and you're good to go. And basically every single person I talk to, their eyes light up and go, oh man, this is really going to change the landscape. And we're like, yes, like it's going to be very rare in the future where you have a single family home. Like everything is going to be multi-unit, and that's really going to be the only way that most people afford to own homes.
Yeah, we've spoken a lot about it on this podcast because we look at it from an investor standpoint, and that's really kind of opened up the opportunity and another way of thinking about investing in single family homes. Now, long before this was kind of mandated, I was drawing our listeners' attention to what's happening, for instance, in the U.S., because so much of what happens down in the U.S. travels north, you know, to us. But in the U.S., there are huge investment funds that traditionally were in the, you know, high-rise multifamily business or were in the office industry, like, you know, building, developing, owning large office towers. And these funds, which have a great deal of disposable money available to them, are now buying complete development projects. I'm not talking about like, I'm talking about residential development projects. It would be like a builder announcing that they're going to build 225 single family homes south of the city. And one of these large funds would come in and buy the entire project before it's ever, you know, presented to the public. Now, the idea is not for resale. The idea is for rental. Because as you so very aptly pointed out, Nick, and something that we've spoken about a great deal, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to turn around and own a single family home. And in a lot of cases, that's not going to happen for you unless you have access or the ability to build or develop the property, or unless the home that you're buying has already an auxiliary dwelling unit. So these large funds, just to close that loop, they're buying these units because they recognize that home ownership is no longer a right. And it isn't. And a lot of people mistakenly think that, well, we live in Canada here, for instance, or we live in the States and, you know, we have a right to buy a house. Well, it's not a question of right. It's a question of ability. These people don't understand that in other parts of the world, that's not the way naturally that someone is going to either fall into or own a residence. Take our friends in the UK, for instance, and we do have listeners in the UK. Homes in the UK will go through 2, 3, sometimes 4 generations. It's kept within the family. And one of the reasons for that is because it is extremely expensive to purchase real estate in the UK. So we're just seeing a worldwide trend or something that is de facto reality in other parts of the world, and that is coming to North America. So you've got these large funds investing in these huge projects because they realize that the future is going to be or is in renting single-family homes out because most people can't afford to buy, but they can afford to rent. So that's a trend that's happening right now as we speak in the States. So here in Canada, yes, we're seeing the effects of just not enough housing. That's what it's all about. We've got very, very liberal, to use the term both literally and figuratively, immigration policies that are bringing in 1 million new residents a year. Well, according to the latest stats that I read, we're not building 225,000 new single-family homes a year. Like, we're not. So where are these people going to go? That adds added pressure to the residential housing market. And this, Bill 23, and the solutions that you've presented so well, Nick, are really, at the end of the day, that's the way we're going to get through this. But this presents a unique opportunity for investors. And that's what I've been really pushing. I've been presenting to some of my clients, you know, the possibility of look at this a different way. Rather than going out and paying, you know, incredibly low rates of return for like a multi-unit dwelling, consider buying a single family home and creating a multi-unit building out of it. It's much, much more cost effective, much more cost effective. But again, that's a talk we could go on, or I could go on for on and on and on and on. But I don't want to take anything more away from what you've said. So a little bit of a soliloquy there, listeners. Sorry about that. Bernie.
Taking all that into consideration, and you know, it's an opportunity for the homeowner, but also let's flip it over. It's an opportunity to the investors. The demand is right there. The supply is in short need. And so that you can meet that. So two things that pop right in my head are, you know, is this something an investor should be looking at? and then, you know, look at, let's say, two or three residential units, and then come to Nicholas and say, listen, I need to convert this. You know, what are my costs? What are my timelines to make that happen? Can that happen?
I think you're both preaching to the choir here. So thank you. That was great. It's like you took the words right out of my mouth. And yeah, I couldn't agree more everything that you said. I mean, even I remember an article that stands out to me back in 2021. It was the Toronto Development Group Core. They usually do like big condo developments. Stated, great article for everyone to see. They're like, we vow to spend $1 billion acquiring single family homes in Ontario. And you know, when the big boys are starting to play like that and they're throwing a lot of cash at it, you go, huh, maybe there's something to this. And then oddly enough, shortly after that, Bill 23 comes out and says, you can go and turn single homes into three units. And I mean, you can go down your conspiracy theory road, you know, if you wish, I'll let you take that sidetrack. But it's very interesting. You know, you see that information come out and you think, okay. And exactly like you said, we've got, you know, large amounts of immigration to help grow GDP and to help grow our country here. But we just don't have enough houses. And, you know, the most amount of houses we built was back in like 1974. We built 220,000 houses, right? We barely scratched 200,000. We can't keep up. We need shelter for people. Like, we're literally like, hey, guys, come on over to our house. Oh, yeah, we don't have any space for you. It's like, what? You just brought us here to this country. There's no room. This is crazy. So,
yeah, I think the last figure I heard was that we were only putting out 125,000 homes, you know, at one point in time. And that article you speak about, It was an article that I quoted in our In the News segment, the same article. And then there was a follow-up to that last year, same group, core group, that I actually quoted as well. And I think it was a development group that invested, it was a huge amount of money, I think $10 million or something in single family homes at the time, is now spending, it was even more money this year coming up. I think it was $100 million or something in single family homes just recently last year. So I know exactly what you speak of. Isn't that funny? Small world.
And it's very, you know, I think anytime you get a piece of information, you ask the five whys, right? And you'll eventually get to the truth of it. And, you know, my speculation on it is when you dig to the, like, why would they do that? If they make huge amounts of money building condos and turning them over, you know, you can buy the small piece of land, you can invest money. You just go, why would you spread it out over so many properties? Why would you? It seems like more brain damage. So obviously it isn't. It's got to be more lucrative. And really, I think the biggest difference is, circling all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, when you go and you get a piece of property, you think, what's my highest and best use? Well, often that highest and best use requires a ton of cash and a ton of time and no results. So you're carrying a property, you've got basically an asset just sitting, and you're pouring cash into it, hoping for a yes, hoping for a grand slam on one property. Where the beauty with the Bill 23 and the single family homes is, again, you take a single home, you've got 100% approval from a zoning perspective anywhere to basically turn it into three units. All you have to do is meet the building code requirements. You don't have development fees. You don't have all these fees. You don't have this long process that's going to take years. You literally just, we draw you up a plan, we submit for permit, and we build it. And within 6 months, you've got a turning triplex. So you've gone from a single family home you bought for $600K, you put $300,000-$400,000 into it, you're in for about $1 million, and now you have a triplex for $1 million, a brand new triplex for $1 million. Like, you go onto realtor.ca right now and you put in recent sales from triplexes, and a garbage dump is being sold for $1 million. Brand new beautiful ones are starting at 1.2 and ranging north of $2 million.
Yeah, so $500,000 per unit. You bring up a very interesting point, and this flows very nicely into the next question. And I pull this from for those who don't know, OGC has a wonderful series of newsletters at the issue. And one was entitled Converting a Single Unit into Three Using No Money Down. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about how a property owner can convert a single unit into three units using no money down?
Yeah, it really comes down to basically like future value financing, right? Anytime you take a property, you add value to it, or you have future value that you're going to be adding to it. When lenders see that, when they see the equity position increasing and they see the cash flow, they'll lend for that. So basically, we take, again, that property. We say, okay, you've bought it for $600,000. We need to put $300,000 or $400,000 into it. What does that look like once it's built? That future value, that future version of the home. What are the comparables? If that was built today, how much would that sell for? And so we look at those appraisals and basically we say, yeah, our clients are going to be in for $1 million. But as if it was built today, future value is at 1.5. So we're doing all of this and it's going to put a $500,000 equity position into the client's pockets, right? The banks easily look at that and go, yeah, no problem. We'll give you the 400,000. Easy. That's wonderful. You're doubling the investment in cash, right? And so that's how you end up financing these. And they're very easy to do when those equity positions exist like that, right?
I hope you're listening, listeners, because it's what we've been preaching here on the show for, I don't know how long now, Bernie, but case in point, coming directly from Nick's mouth to your ears.
If there are no problems.
There are no opportunities, and Nick's here to solve, you know, those problems by presenting investors with very real opportunities. Bernie, you want to take us home?
Well, I'm just going to go back on the no money down. Are there any grants that help support that, that, you know, encourage housing growth other than the Bill 23, which is not a grant, but are there any funds that you're finding either from municipalities or from province or the feds to enhance growth?
Yeah, there are some that exist. I never really honestly comment on them because I find they change so quickly and there's such detailed criteria for approval. So we work with a couple companies, actually one in particular that just handles all grants, HST, tax rebates, all of that. They're a bigger organization called Access Rebates. They're actually a Toronto-based company, but we've been working with Mark and his team. And anytime we get a project, I literally just send it over to them and say, what's applicable in this case based on the client profile, based on the project type to do there. One of the biggest things that exists, I think that's super helpful, but not helpful for the three-unit buildings, helpful for the multis over 5 units, is that the government has taken off the taxes, the full HST on any new build or modified projects to create over 5 units. So if you're getting into that scale of project, that's a humongous incentive to build something today and save that 13%.
Kind of the final question is density-based zoning. How does that differ from use-based zoning?
Yeah. So I think a lot of where this comes from is that the city of Ottawa is going to be changing the new official plan. You know, fingers crossed coming up soon. But the approval was given. They're just working on the details right now. And we've been very fortunate to speak directly with David Wise and his senior team and had a lot of great conversations to, you know, help take loopholes and pitfalls out of it. And it's been really a really wonderful process with them. But ultimately, what's happening is the current zoning that's in place, you know, your R1 through R5 is a use or typology-based zoning. And really what that is you look at the zoning and it says R1, you can build single family homes, you know, R3, you can build semis and triplexes, R4, you can build multis. So it's really the type of project that the zoning is based around. And what the new zoning is going to switch to is density or form-based type zoning. And essentially that is more focused on the massing of the project, really just the build volume. So essentially what size of box can I build on a piece of property is what it's going towards. And the key areas would be density. So how many units per hectare can we do? The form, which would be building heights, footprints, and how it fits within the overall characteristics of the neighborhood. So if, you know, the traditional neighborhood is all two-story single family homes, you know, you're not going to come in and build a 17-story skyscraper right next to them. But what you probably can do is, odds are it's bigger single family home lots. You could build a nice 2 or 3 story building that looks like a single family home. It's maybe twice as deep, 2 or 3 times the volume, and you might be able to put 8 units into it. So that's kind of where the zoning is going to. And the third component is really the function. How will these projects impact stormwater, infrastructure, traffic patterns, that sort of thing. So it's a different way to look at zoning, what I think is a much better way of looking at the zoning so that communities will look very consistent. But then, you know, the areas that are really close to transit, close to major roadways, close to amenities will have the opportunity to go higher density. Again, without having you look at some areas in Westboro, you got your little tiny bungalow, lots of trees around it, you know, and then you've got next door to it this like 14-story skyscraper. And you're like, I don't think either person really likes that clashing lifestyle side by side, right?
And if I do, let's say, add 2 more dwellings or 1 more dwelling inside the space, then the bank loves it. Is there also a benefit to the homeowner or the investor where the existing property is going through an upgrade at the same time In other words, you know, as you're moving around in the structure, do you also enhance what is there? So you're bringing everything up to speed to a certain extent, whether it's the exterior or other elements?
Yeah, 100%. Going direct to the numbers, usually as you're making that improvement, whatever you're improving is now going to have a higher value from an equity position and also from a rental perspective, right? You've got an old, outdated property. Maybe you rent it for $2,000 a month. We do a $100,000 improvement and it looks like a brand new building. Odds are you're going to capture more than that on rental income once you list that back on the market as essentially a new unit. And again, going all the way back to one of the earlier questions with, you know, the flat cost and when's the best time to do projects and how much should you group together? I think it's always in a client's best interest to do as much as they can in one go. It ultimately saves them money. And even honestly, like renovations, construction, it's annoying, right? Like they call it divorce dust for a reason. It's not fun and exciting. Like I'm, again, you've seen my extreme kind of personality. When I'm home and I'm zen, I don't want somebody banging away, working on the house. Like I don't want the noise. I don't want the dust. Like don't agitate me. So when you're going to go through a process, just rip off the Band-Aid, get it all done in one shot, get it nice and new and fresh, get that thing refinanced, get people in there, get some cash flow going, right?
Great answer. Okay. So let's move on to the more less formal questions. We've got some rapid fire questions for you. So Nick, what's your morning routine like?
Wake up. We got the gym right across from the bedroom. So hit the gym, get that out of the way, get fired up for the morning, instantly jump in, do the hot and cold shower. And then it's quick three egg omelet, coffee, tea. And then I'm out the door hitting a great podcast like Property Wizards, soaking up my knowledge for the morning. As soon as I get to work, I like to action all my tasks to the teams, make sure everybody has their priorities. And then usually the day before I leave, I set my top three priorities for the next day. So I jump in, crush out my three priorities, crush out any calls that we need, and then into meetings all day.
And what time does this blessed event start?
It depends on whose alarm clock goes off first. My wife is a teacher and she's now coaching the basketball team. So the alarm clock has started going off at about 5 a.m. So the good thing is that the cardio sessions have now gotten longer, which is great. Hopefully the body fat percentage will start to show that shortly as well.
Good for you. Bernie.
What's your favorite book, sir?
Favorite book that stood out in my mind recently is actually from David Goggins, the autobiography Can't Hurt Me. And it stands out. Mostly the main principle, although the guy's pretty intense, pretty crazy dude, was really just your body, your comfort level, you know, mentally, physically always wants to shut you off at about 60, 70%. And you've always got to override that system. Success, great things, growth always comes from pushing yourself past that default set comfort line that kicks in. And I think that was the general wonderful message that I think applies every day, all day long to life is just push past that barrier, go.
Sounds to me like you're living that already, Nick.
It sounds like your cardio sessions in the morning, just a little bit more.
That's it. It literally is. It's David Goggins' voice in my mind when you're like, I want to get off. And you hear that voice being like, push more, like until you feel like you're going to vomit or pass out, you know. That's about it. And even at that, I think odds are you're not going to throw up. Odds are you're not going to pass out. Just push.
Oh, the only time I ever think that way is when I'm drinking a really good bottle of scotch. Push more. I don't know. I think Bernie will turn around and agree with that.
Yes, very much so.
Oh my God, I love it. You know what? It applies to everything. Everything you do, you know, push. You don't know your limit till you exceed it, right? And I think that's that even goes back to a favorite hobby of car racing, right? You truly don't know the limit till you've stepped over it. So,
well, here we go. Favorite hobby or pastime?
Yes.
Let's move right into that one. What's your favorite hobby or pastime?
I love it. It is car racing. Whether it's even down to go karts, but I have a little race car that I try to get up to Calabogie Racetrack as often as I can. They're a wonderful team there, wonderful people. You know, Jay at Power Sports takes care of the car. Jane Blinn runs the show there. Wonderful, wonderful humans. They make that amazing goal that I've always had in my life happen. And it's a wonderful thing to do. When you're sitting there, foot to the floor, when you think, oh my God, I should be putting on the brakes, and you're committing to going through a corner, going like 200 kilometers an hour, and there's a concrete wall about 3 inches away from your car. You don't have time to question your life decisions. You don't have time to think. It's just make a decision, execute, and commit to whatever you're doing. And be present in the moment. It's an extreme form of meditation, I think.
I knew there was a reason why I like this guy.
Never thought of going 200K an hour as a form of meditation.
Might oh, never best. Mind. We know what kind of driver you are. German, Autobahn. I mean, this guy drives. You know what? He'd be right at home at Calabogie. Don't let his mild manner fool you, Nick.
I love it. I love it. Well, I've got a passenger seat. I specifically put a passenger seat in with the harnesses and everything. So anytime.
Harness. I'd love to have you. Who needs a harness? Just go for the ride. Just don't fly out. So I guess the next question is, what do you do to relax when you're not meditating at 200K an hour?
Oh, I love it. What do I do to bring that down to the Zen level, the opposite Zen level, right? That way. Always try to get the gym sessions in. I think that brings you into a calm, focused state once it's finished. I like to spend a lot of time reading, you know, having fires and stuff outside with the kids and hanging out. We like to go to nature and, you know, do a lot of walks, go swimming, go just explore new places and just spend time with the family. I think it's what brings me down a lot and gives me a lot of joy to see their interest and curiosity and their stories and just spending that great time connecting.
Well, enjoy it, Nick, because they grow up real fast, and both Bernie and I can attest to that for sure. So enjoy every moment you can with them. So tell me, what's your favorite place in the world to visit?
Yeah, a new favorite spot that has been a consistent favorite spot, I guess, is Turks and Caicos. We've been very fortunate that my in-laws are retired. They're wonderful, wonderful people. They live a couple doors down from us. And every year we typically do a nice holiday with them. And since they're retired, they've typically picked nice warm places. And the most consistent one we've gone to is Turks and Caicos. Wonderful little patch of sand in the middle of the Caribbean. Go hang out, spend time with the family, just, you know, relax, exercise, go play on some sea-doos and stuff.
And I suppose you're racing those sea-doos, or you found a track down there somewhere to truly enjoy the Zen.
That's it. Yeah, it is, I socialize a lot as a living and there's a lot of intensity, but definitely I flip to that pure, like, leave me alone. I'm going over in my corner. I'm just going to read my book. I want silence. Don't talk to me. You know, let me actually calm down. But yeah, even when you're in the middle of paradise, it's like, oh, you have supercharged sea-doos, eh? Do you think I could send that off a wave and get 8 feet of air? And they're like, well, sir, you're not supposed to do that. I'm like, don't worry, I got a race license. It's okay. Just, you know, give me the keys. Let's go.
8 feet of air? Yeah. It's not the going up that hurts. It's the impact.
It's the coming down. Well, you can learn that the hard way, because they're no joke. There is, like, I've watched the guys that, they own the sea-doo companies, right? And you see them out there doing the tricks and you're like, oh, if they can do it, I'm sure I can. And you see them jump the waves, and that's the big test, right? Is if you go fast enough, you hit the wave the right way, you actually jump the wave and land on the next wave smoothly. But if you mess it up, yeah, that's where you're like, oh, I think I just broke a rib on the handlebar, you know, and not the most ideal thing you want to have happen on holiday.
Well, that come out with a jellyfish on your face too, if you dive in hard enough.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough. That's it. We love it.
If you could have a coffee or tea with one person that's alive now, or that's, you know, been alive in the past, who would it be?
Obviously, besides Bernie and Fred, right?
that would be a beverage of our choice. Then it wouldn't be the tea or the coffee.
Yeah, tea.
I sense a common theme of whiskey happening. So I know the way to your heart now. Yeah.
It's one of them.
Food's another way, but that's another podcast.
I love it. I love it. Well, that's where I'll have to bring my wife in. I'm truly a very blessed, spoiled individual. My wife is like chef level cook. Like my wow. Monday morning, like, leftover lunch is like a 5-star restaurant, you know, meal. So I'm very, very lucky and surprised that, thankfully she's very focused on nutrition along with good flavor. Otherwise I'd probably be like 400 pounds. One person that really stands out in my mind right now that I would love to meet is actually Bill Gates. I think his made himself independently wealthy and then now spends his time on philanthropy and seems to be actually taking actions to make the world a better place. And I think, you know, as time progresses, you realize that you get one shot on this earth, and the best thing that you can do is to help people and help the world become a better place than you got it when you leave. And I would love to sit down and just see what this guy's doing and talk to him and understand that mindset. And I think, I'd grow a tremendous amount as a person, just even having 15 minutes with Bill Gates.
Wonderful. What a wonderful way to finish up. What's the word of the day today, Bernie?
It's time for the Property Wizard's word of the day.
Well, Fred, it's a parapet wall.
Parapet wall. What on earth is a parapet wall? Sounds like a Dr. Seuss book or something like that.
Well, I was almost said parrot wall, but you know.
Yeah. Well, a parapet wall is a wall, usually along the perimeter of a flat roof system that extends up higher than the roof itself. The entire purpose of a parapet wall, though, is to give the roofing membrane, and this is for a flat roof, remember, the roofing membrane a place to terminate above the roof surface and to minimize the threat of perimeter roof leakage. So they didn't necessarily have flat roofs. And the reason for parapet walls going back into the 18 and the 1900s was purely for cosmetic reasons. You'd see these buildings that were single story, sometimes two, and the front walls would extend well past the roof line. That was more an architectural reason for having a wall extend like this. This is much more functional. A parapet wall is meant specifically for that purpose. And you're not going to see a parapet wall on any type of a regular shingle roof system. It would be highly unlikely. But where you're going to see it and where it serves a functional purpose is on a flat roof system. Thank you for that, Bernie. Nick, thank you for being our guest today. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of questions for you. What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
Fred, Bernie, thank you so much for having me on the Property Wizard podcast today. I really appreciate it. This has been an absolute pleasure. Lots of fun. I'm glad that you guys have this platform that you're getting knowledge and information out to the masses to help everyone solve these problems here. Best way to get a hold of us, you can reach me direct, actually, by phone, by text, 613-806-3172. You can send me an email. It's Nick, N-I-C-K, at OttawaGeneralContractors.com. You can check out our website, OttawaGeneralContractors.com. You can go on our Facebook account, Instagram, any of the social media platforms, reach out to us. We've got our main line you can call. You can go into our live chat and be like, hey, I want to talk to Nick. And then it'll just send it direct to me. I'd say that's the way most people do, is go on the live feed and say, I want to talk to Nick. And it just sends it direct to me that way.
Brilliant. And we'll make sure that all those means of getting a hold of you are listed on our podcast notes as well. So thank you again, Nick. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you. You're an invaluable guest. I'm sure we're going to have you back. So join us next podcast when we'll be discussing how to evaluate your business with special guest Carolyn Troy. Anything you care to add, Bernie?
You know, Fred, this has been fascinating. There are some things I know, and there are some things that I now know. So, Nick, thank you so much. Now, how to add value to the house, how to get your house refurbished or refreshed, add a new revenue stream. Yeah, bonus. It's courtesy of a lot of the government and supply and demand of housing. But yes, it's really good to know. So, folks, if you have any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. Info@gentryres.com.
Wonderful. Again, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.